Honourable members and colleagues and Demasi, can we start? It's our first nine.
Yes, Chairperson, you can start.
Okay. Can you then flag the agenda of today's meeting?
Okay, Chair.
Thank you. Can I close my video because there's low shedding here since 8 o'clock?
Okay, apologies for that, Chair. Let me just load it again. Can you see, Chair?
Very much, Masi, and this honorable members and colleagues, this is the agenda for today's meeting, and you are all welcome to this meeting, and all of you, I know that today the department is led by the DG and the PSC is also here. You are all welcome and all colleagues. We can move, Masi, to apologies. I understand there's three apologies. I saw in the platform, in the portfolio committee group, the apology of Mr. Chebekulu, who have been requested that at least by 12:30, he must be released to go and see the doctor. There's an apology of the minister. Today, it's Wednesday, and it's always cabinet meetings, physical cabinet meetings. And I also saw that there's an apology also of the DM. I understand she's somewhere with the DDM program of the executive, and I'm not sure if there's further apologies, Masi, from your side.
You've captured them all, Chairperson. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. So we are done with the apologies. Honorable members, this today's meeting is to, one, receive the presentation from the Department of Public Service and Administration, and also a presentation from the Public Service Commission, and the department will then present on the progress made with regards to the implementation of the 2019 and to 2024 medium-term strategic indicators. And you'll understand that as this committee, we have been conducting oversight over this department, which is the DPSA and its entities in implementing the strategic plan targets over the past year since 2019 to date. And therefore, the information to be presented by this department today is a build up towards the drafting of the committee of this portfolio committee legacy report on the sixth administration. And immediately after, the department will also receive the presentation of the Public Service Commission on Handbook for members of the PSC and the Code of Conduct for all the commissioners. And then because the minister is not here and also the deputy minister is not here, just before the presentation of the department, I will hand over to the DG, and then immediately after the DG, the presenter will take over. Honorable members and colleagues. DG? Ms. Marcus?
Thank you, Chairperson. Apologies for that delay. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Portfolio Committee members. Good morning, members of the PSC and colleagues from PSC and the PSA. Chairperson, I also have a challenge but I just request permission to step out of the meeting. I am not sure when, but I am expected to support the minister in the cabinet committee on a presentation that we are doing there on issues related to our coordination role in terms of the work we do with the Fusion Center around fighting crime. It's an OECD submission. So I have colleagues here in the meeting who will take over the presentation, but I will just do the introductory part of the presentation. Just in terms of the introduction, Ms. Linda Dludla is going to take over from me in terms of the presentation. There's also the CFO who will speak on the financial issues. Just in terms of the introductory part, whilst Ms. Dludla is uploading the presentation, I just want to highlight a few issues, Chair, in relation to this presentation. That firstly, we are presenting a progress report, or we're updating the committee on progress in terms of the MTSF. What have we achieved? What are some of the things that are still outstanding from an MTSF point of view? I do want to highlight, Chairperson, that the 2019-24 medium-term strategic framework is a five-year implementation plan for the NDP. I think we all know that. And the Minister for Public Service and Administration was allocated indicators and related targets under priority one. That is that the priority of a capable, ethical and developmental state. The department developed a roadmap to track and monitor implementation of the MTSF interventions and targets, including other strategic policy priorities that the DPSA needs to implement during this MTSF period. And we have developed and tabled our strategic plan in June 2020 to the committee, and both the strategic plan and APPs are informed by and aligned to priority one of the MTSF, which is building a capable, ethical and developmental state. So this presentation highlights key achievements year by year, because the MTSF is a five-year plan. However, we implement it through the annual performance contract, through the annual performance plans on an annual basis. And so we will focus on that in terms of implementation. We track this work through the cluster system, amongst others, and we also provide biannual reports to cabinet under the leadership of Minister and the Presidency. Our MPSA leads in 6 targets and supports in 11 targets. So you'll see the structure of the presentation, that we focus first on the 6 targets and we provide year-on-year performance in terms of those 6 targets. Those are the targets the minister is leading on. And then we provide a summary table in terms of the 11 targets that the minister is supporting other ministers on. However, we have included an annexure that gives a little bit more detail in terms of the other 11 targets that you are supporting, so that members can further read. Chair, just moving into key performance highlights, and I'm hoping that colleagues are showing the slides and are on the slide 1.3 that talks to the key performance highlights. Some of the things we want to highlight in the current term is that the ethics infrastructure has been established in the public service and includes, amongst others, initially we had issued that in terms of the regulations there must be designation of ethics officers in each department. We have since reviewed that and now added that EAs can appoint ethics officers through the establishments that they have in their own structures in the departments. Then there's also establishment of ethics committees in departments which must be chaired by an SMS member. Initially, in the regulations, we had indicated that they must be chaired by a DDG, but there are also departments that do not have DDGs, and they struggle to convene these meetings. Hence, we've had to expand to look at reviewing the regulations in terms of this. Ethics surveys are done every 3 years. We have a partnership with the Ethics Institute, as well as funded by the Canadians in terms of the Canadian government in terms of the ethics survey. And this helps us to establish measurement on how we are performing and also a baseline that we are working on for the next 3 years. Mobilization of international donors to support this work. We have three main international donors to support this work. We have the World Bank that supports us a lot with training. We have UNODC as well that supports us with training, especially around issues related to lifestyle audits, training for departments. We also have the Canadian government that really supports our work right through in terms of ethics, from training, capacity building, to some of the research areas that we are focusing on. In terms of governance mechanisms, lastly, we participate in the Fusion Center, which is a capability that brings all law enforcement under one roof to track corruption cases and to coordinate corruption cases. DPSA participation is really aimed at better coordination and processing of corruption cases that involve public servants. And when we pick up these cases in the system, we refer them to the relevant departments who are supposed to take certain actions in relation to those. From a governance mechanism point of view, just in terms of wage negotiations and wage bill management, we have established very solid governance mechanisms in terms of at the ministerial level. We have the ministerial committee that guides the processes, and at a technical level, we have our policy, we have our processes there on how we engage with these particular processes. We have done an extensive review of a personnel expenditure in government, and this process we led it as DPSA, but in partnership with national and provincial government departments and other state agencies. This report is due to be taken to cabinet. We've already discussed it with Treasury, and we have a date with FOSAT, I think early in February now, and then it must go to cabinet. We have launched the amendments of the public service regulations. So some of the issues I'm referring to already relates to the amendments. In terms of the professionalization framework, now we are at a stage where we are implementing the professionalization framework. Part of the amendments of the public service regulations had to do with integrating professionalization framework issues, amongst others. Some of those issues are in the legislation, and some of those issues are in specific directives that the department is processing. We have done legislative amendments. I think the portfolio committee is fully aware of that process. I won't spend time there. But we were supported by partners, in particular the PSCBC and NETLEC, in this process because we consulted extensively with them. We have reviewed, we have released our country's second generation review report through the APRM instrument, and this report was presented to the AU by the president. And we will be launching this report in South Africa. The president will be launching it on the 12th of December. We will be hosting the 20th anniversary celebrations for the APRM in South Africa. In terms of IT, there are interventions we have done as the department in terms of leveraging on cloud technologies, strengthening cybersecurity posture of the public service, implementing ICT service continuity, as well as strengthening the governance of ICT. There are determinations and directives we have issued that we are monitoring in terms of implementation. Cabinet also approved in the current financial year the HOD performance management system for implementation in 2024. Again, an instruction will be issued around that particular issue. The business process mapping program was developed and approved. There's more detail because it's one of the MTSF priorities or targets for our minister. However, I think it's important to say that we are noticing a move from government in terms of automation of business processes. This is just but one part of a digital government that we think there's some movement, especially in certain provinces and in certain departments compared to others. However, we will issue a consolidated report at the end of the financial year. We're just providing progress in terms of this report. The organizational functional assessment is a tool that we use to support the departments to look at how they can improve functionality in their departments. And this is also a tool that we developed as DPSA and is implemented. The last part, Chair, I am going to speak on before I hand over to the DDG. Or to the CFO, then to the DDG, is around key risk and mitigation that we have faced in terms of key risk we have faced and the mitigation we have put in place in terms of these areas. just going through the risk, we faced a risk of delays as we were reorganizing the department in the 2019-2020 financial year. And we really started implementation of the structure in 2020 with the SMS structure. And 2021, we completed the rollout of the microstructure, which required quite a number of consultations and engagements with labor and other internal structures. We've also had COVID-19 outbreak, which slowed down performance due to different forms of shutdown. So 2020-21 financial year, we spent more time on shutdowns as a department, as a country. However, we did develop catch-up plans to ensure that we still meet our targets. Hence, we are able to report a number of our targets on track. Budget cuts and reprioritization. Treasury did budget cuts to channel money to minimize the impact of COVID. We were cushioned a little bit because we have partnerships in some areas, especially like the area of the technical advisory unit. We have very solid partnerships there. There is also reduced capacity in terms of related to the budget cuts. We lost 60 vacancies. As funds were cut by Treasury, and that had a big impact on our capacity as the department. We further recently have lost about 8 vacancies, again, due to funding that has been done by Treasury in the current financial year. I think they took back 10% of budgets from departments. The legal mandate of MPSA is limited to service, to public service, which cause mandate issues as targets require public sector-wide approach. From a mitigation point of view, yes, there is intergovernmental cooperation. However, we think that there is an important role that must be played at the, when we are with the new MTSF cycle. From a planning perspective, the planning between the department that is leading and the departments that are supporting is very important, and this must be done at the initial stages, so that we avoid the to and fro, which takes a lot of time before the implementation of programs. There's also delays we experience due to negotiation process. Negotiations by their own, they are protracted processes. We think that though, if we align at least at a planning process, especially looking at the economic outlook and those engagements we have before the actual negotiations start, we are able to save more time. We've seen how this worked better in the last term of the negotiations compared to the previous terms as we started implementing that idea. We have limited M&E capacity at DPSA, and this affects impact-based approaches. And this limited capacity really has to do with the type of resources that we have and the fact that we have experienced a budget cuts, and these budget cuts were against vacant positions, and some of these positions were new positions that were created in the structure as in order to deal with the issues, amongst other, of M&E to strengthen our capability. However, we have invested in an early warning system as a department. We are also looking at utilizing existing employees, especially within the OSC, the Office on Standards Compliance that we have, whose main role is monitoring implementation of standards in the public sector, that we can tap into capability there, but build more capability as a department. And there's work that has started in respect to that particular area. Chair, on this note, I would like to request to hand over to the CFO, who will present on 2 slides, and then the DDG will take over on the actual performance. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. You can go ahead.
Thank you, DG. Good morning, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee and colleagues from the PSC. I'm just going to quickly just highlight two slides under financial performance over the MTSF. I think this would be just for noting by the honorable members, because over the years we have this committee has played oversight role on the on the financial performance as well that we had come quarterly to present to the portfolio committee on this. So we're just highlighting the amounts that were utilized to support the MTSF target. The financial information that we are indicating here, it assisted among other things on the other work that the department did, as well as programs. We just indicating the total budget that supported also the MTSF, starting on the right hand side with year one, which is 2020-2021, and year two, 2021-22, and 2022-23, which is year three, and the last year, which is the current year, which is 2023-24. We indicating the budget for that particular year and the expenditure for the year, as well as the money that is spent, like in program one administration in the first year, the budget was 220 million, and the expenditure for that particular year was 210 million. And we indicating the same information in year two and year three, and in the current year, the budget went up to 271, and the expenditure so far is 133. This budget assisted in the under the narratives in the implementation of PAMA legal services, where we indicating the activities under the various financial year 2021-22, the PAMA consultation, as well as the cabinet approval. And the second budget was under HRMND, which is we're also indicating the same budget on the first year, which was 47 million, and 44 million was the expenditure in that first year. And the unspent amount was 2.7. And in the current year, the budget has moved up a bit to 47 million. And so far, we've spent 26 million, and the amount that still has to be spent in the current year is 2021, and that is also the amount that assists with the implementation of the work that the department is doing together with the MTSF. And we also indicating under the narratives the stabilized public service 2021, there was job competency framework, occupational dictionary that was developed, as well as under the effective implementation of public service policies, annual compliance monitoring was submitted for approval. The last slide, Honorable Chair, which is the next slide, indicates the other three programs. If you can go to the next slide, Linda. In the next slide, we're indicating the negotiations, labor relations, and remuneration management. In the first year, the budget allocated in that year 2020-2021 was 669 million, and the spent amount at that year was 58 million, with an unspent budget of 11 million. And going up to the fourth year, which is this current year, so far we had a budget of 89 million. And the budget, the expenditure so far is 46 million, still left with 43 million that still has to be spent. And the e-government services and information management, which is the program four, which also contributes to the MTSF target. The first year budget was 22.9 million, and the expenditure at that particular year was 20.7 million, and currently in the 2023-24, the current budget is 24 million, and 9.7 million has been spent. The money still has to be spent is 14 million. And the last budget allocation went to the government service access and improvement, which is program five, which also contributes to the MTSF targets. The first year, the budget was 108 million, and the spending at that year was 96.4 million. And in the current year, the budget still is 108 million. The spending so far is in the current year is 59.3 million. And we still have 48.8 million to spend. And under the narratives, we indicating, Honorable Chair and members, the activities that took place under the various targets, stabilized public service in the 2020-21, was a consultation on the implementation of the organizational functionality assessment tool. And in the following year, there was directive also on organizational functionality assessment tool, which was issued, and the other activity that took place under negotiations, labor relations and management was the personnel expenditure review, as the DG has indicated earlier on. The job evaluation system was also developed, and we do have also indicate the next target, which is effective implementation of public service policies. We indicating for the first year, which is 2020-21, the audit report on implementation of the National E-Government Strategy, which was issued. The National E-Government Strategy is institutionalized, and the IT service continuity policy framework, which was developed. And in 2022-23, there was business process mapping modernization program implementation, which continued in this particular year. And lastly, Honorable Chair, is the improved implementation of particular principles, and we indicating the two activities in the two financial year. That brings me to the highlights in terms of the financial allocations over the MTSF with regard to the target. I'll hand over to the DDG Linda to continue the presentation on the details of the MTSF target. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, CFO. Good morning, Chair, and honorable members, as well as colleagues from the Public Service Commission. As DG indicated, the minister had a target that she was directly responsible to implement, which were six. We have since corrected, because I think the presentation that was sent to the committee indicated that we had 11 such targets. So we had six that minister was leading, and then 11 that we were submitting. And just to also note that what we're presenting here is already in the APP for 2023-24 that we have reported to the committee to date in terms of our first quarter and second quarter reports for this year. Similarly, the quarterly reports that we have been presenting since 2020 have also presented on these targets. So we are saying that targets are on track because the MTSF ends in March 2024. So on track means we are on track on achieving the targets by the end of the MTSF period. Some of the targets, as you will see, was that in year one of the MTSF, we were supposed to have the draft public amendment bill produced by 2021. We are therefore reflecting that that target was achieved. In year two, ending in March 2022, we're supposed to revise the public service, to develop the revised public service amendment bill, and to submit the bill to cabinet. We are saying that the target, the bill was publicly consulted. The consultation process at the PSCBC was extended and finalized in 2022-23. With the 2023 target, we're supposed to table the revised public service amendment bill to parliament. That was done, and therefore we are recording those targets as achieved. With respect to the business process modernization program, the program was piloted over
a scheduled 5-year period. Development of a BPM program, onboarding of departments, the year 4 is this year, and then in year 5 we are going to continue with the implementation support to departments and do the reporting or the status of implementation of the program, which would be a monitoring report that would be concluded on by March 2024, which will then give us a sense of how many departments are implementing the program, how many are on track, how many do need support, so that the outer years will then, the targets for the outer years will be informed by the findings of the monitoring. So some of the work that has been done in terms of the departments, I won't read all of them. Over the 3 years since we started implementing, we've worked with the Environmental Affairs, Sports, Arts and Culture, Gauteng departments, including the Office of the Premier and the Economic Development and Culture departments. 2022, these are some of the departments we work with: Limpopo, COGTA, KZN Education, and the Northwest Human Settlements. The year that we are under now, which is 2023-24, we've worked with DECO, Northern Cape Office of the Premier, Office of the Premier and the Western Cape, South African Police Service, Human Settlement, as well as our own department, which was also part of the pilot. The job competency framework was supposed to be developed and implemented by 2023. This is of the 6 targets, the 1 target that was delayed due to capacity challenges, and there will be a further explanation. So to date, to augment the capacity that we have in the department, we have established a task team with members from different institutions, including the NSG, UNDP and PCTA, who are going to support us in the development of the job competency. We have also concluded a research that would inform the drafting of the framework. And the implementation is scheduled from 1 April 2024. So in effect, the target will be of implementation will be done a month after it was scheduled to be done. So we should have started with the implementation by the end of March. So we are saying in all respects, therefore, the target is on track for achievement by the end of March 2024, save for the implementation that will start a month after in April 2024. We also had a target of 100% of all departments, national and provincial, who should have been implementing lifestyle audits by 2023-24, noting that the implementation of lifestyle audits is an ongoing process. So the target must therefore be read as from 2023-24, at least all departments should have started with the implementation. So what we are showing here is that in year 1, which was ending in 2021 March, the actual performance was that the lifestyle audit framework was approved, including the lifestyle audit guideline was approved. The actual implementation of departments in effect started in 2022 where by the end of January, in terms of compliant departments, we had 27 national departments, 47 provincial departments, with 87 departments outstanding out of the 161 departments. So the 161 is a combination of both national and provincial departments. In year three, we had a slight regression in terms of national departments, which went down from 27 to 24. Provincial departments increased, and as a result, we had 66 departments outstanding out of the 161 compared to the 87 departments that were still outstanding in year two. In year four, which is the current year, we do not yet have a report. The reports, because we gather reports from all departments, and also because the lifestyle audits emanate from the declaration of financial interest. And the declaration of financial interest happens at different times for different categories. So the department will only have a report, I think, by March, end of March next year. So from there, we will be able to see which departments are compliant and which ones are not compliant. So similarly, in year five, 2024-25, we'll continue with the monitoring compliance by all departments. As we have said, that there was some deviations from the planned targets, and we are indicating what were the main challenges as well as the catch-up plans that we have implemented. So with respect to the 100% achievement on lifestyle audits, that could not be achieved at the end of 2023. The main challenges was on the clarity on the legality to conduct lifestyle audits, as well as the capacity of departments to conduct lifestyle audits. Some departments do not have fully fledged ethics officers and investigators. And because the lifestyle audit was a new process in the public service, some departments didn't readily have the skills to conduct such lifestyle audits. So those were some of the teething problems that the department continues to support departments on, including ongoing training of ethics officers. So the catch-up plan was that we brought on board the World Bank, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, as well as the Canadian government, who developed the courses for ethics officers that I have just mentioned. And we are happy to report that this intervention is yielding results, because as at the end of October 2023, we only had four national departments and nine provincial departments that did not conclude last audits. And we are following up on those departments that are still non-compliant. We were also supposed to implement the target on the professional code of ethics, which should have been institutionalized by 2023. In year one, a fact sheet was produced for SMS members, and the report on compliance with the finance disclosure framework was conducted. In year two, we produced a fact sheet again, as well as reporting on compliance by designated employees. In year three, which ended in March 2023, as in October 2022, the DPSA, together with the National School of Government, reviewed the incorporation of the professional code of ethics into the compulsory induction program, And the assessment that was done by DPS, they found that the module on ethics was effectively and fully incorporated into the NSG's induction program. 2023-24, there was work that was done to then ensure that the code is institutionalized within public administration. And this work will continue in 2024-25 as well. As DG has spoken a bit around some of the key highlights, she mentioned the work on the organizational functionality assessment tool. In 2022-23, which was the first year of the actual implementation post the piloting of the offer tool in the previous years, we issued a directive in April 2022. 50 departments were scheduled to conduct the offer. We also produced the report on the institutionalization of the offer, where 16 departments were issued with notices of non-compliance in terms of Section 16 of the Public Service Act, and they were compelled to submit their report during the cycle, which is 2023. So 27 departments were found to have submitted complete offer reports, 2 partial reports, and the 5 departments were granted deviations by the minister to report during the 2023-24 cycle. Continuing on the work of offer, 4 of the 15 departments submitted their offer reports, and the 3 departments requested and received the deviation. So I think we are just giving details then of the report, the departments that we reported as having complied, not complied, or granted deviations in the previous slide. This is just the 8 departments that we mentioned that did not submit, included communication and digital technologies, international relations and cooperation, public works, transport, as well as water and sanitation. And then 10 of the 12 departments submitted their offer reports, and the Department of Health is one of the departments that didn't submit full reports, and education was granted a deviation. I will skip this one, Chair, in the interest of time, as it's part of the annexures that are giving details to the names of the departments that we have mentioned before. So we also, as I said, the offer, when the directive was issued, there were cycles, so different departments were going to under a specific cycle. So in terms of cycle 2, which is 2023-24, there were a number of departments that were supported by the department, including agriculture, defense, mineral resources, and there were departments that have not yet requested support, and they include correctional services, military veterans, Home Affairs, as well as Employment and Labor. We also supported the following provinces through workshops, as well as the following government components, which is the Government Pensions Administration Agency and the Government Technical Advisory Center. In terms of the future rollout, which will be cycle 3, we will continue to provide implementation support to the departments that fall under the cycle 3. I would not read them out, but they are listed here in terms of the different provinces, as well as the 12 national departments that fall under the cycle 3. So as we've indicated, we were also then supporting 11 other indicators that are led by the different ministers. The key actions that were taken by DPSA in its support role with respect to the establishment of the head of public administration. We did legislative amendments, which are in progress in Parliament. The DG Presidency Performance Agreement or contract for 2023-24 started integrating her role as the head of public administration. There was also a rollout to provincial DGs on finalization of legislation. On the Intergovernmental Support Monitoring and Intervention Bill, that required to be approved by the Parliament. The work is led by COCTA. As DPSA, we made a formal impulse to the bill through our legal services. In terms of the IFMS, DPSA is a member of the IFMS Steering Committee. And as the committee is aware, there is no rollout yet of the IFMS due to delays in procurement. And as well as the SIU investigation, National Treasury has indicated that they are currently seeking legal advice on the investigation that has been issued by the SIU. So as a result, the IFMS 2, I think it's called, on the mandatory in-service training approved by 2020, was led by the NSG. DPSA, as part of its policy mandate, issued the mandatory, or developed rather, the mandatory in-service training directive, which was consulted with the National School of Government, and will be approved during the current financial year by the minister. They were supposed, we were also supposed to support work on the consequence management cases related to corruption. We have supported through ongoing monitoring of disciplinary cases, submitting reports to Foresight as well as Cabinet, and also supporting work on precautionary suspension backlogs by assisting departments to move with the finalization of their case backlogs. We've spoken a lot around the financial disclosures, and what we can report is that as of where we are now, we are at 96% of SMEs that are disclosing their financial interests. The percentage for levels below SMS, which includes levels 12, 11, as well as all supply chain management and financial finance officials, it's still at 60.9%. So the technical assistance unit is working hard to follow up and provide support where required so that the compliance levels for these other categories improve as well. The target on percentage of performance agreements of executive authorities and accounting officers that are responsive to women, youth, and persons with disability priorities. These targets are included in the performance agreement of the DG of DPSA, and monitored accordingly by, or assessed accordingly by, the Department of Women. Friends from the anti-corruption hotline, crime statistics, we are playing a supportive role in that we refer cases to the PSC for investigation. In 2021, 14 cases were referred, 3 cases in 2022, and one case has been closed, and one of these cases was declined. the establishment of the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council. We participated in developing the anti-corruption strategy, NACAC establishment, and also participated in one of the working groups, enabling leadership in national and provincial departments to build capacity and intervene to resolve blockages in government. We have supported this through the professionalization framework, as well as the establishment of the head of public administration. I will not go through the next slides, Chair. I think these were the additional information that the DG referred to as annexures that the committee can then read, just to give more detail on what we have also presented on. But maybe the one that I can touch on is the citizen satisfaction survey to indicate that in the period April to March, the department conducted a research study that focuses on the efficacy of regulated service delivery improvement mechanisms. And it is part of the target that deals with dealing with blockages in government. So we're looking particularly blockages around the delivery of services to citizens. We will look, as I said, at the efficacy of the existing mechanisms. And with the research was both qualitative and quantitative. And the department was using 5 service delivery dimensions that the research was based on, and which was the citizen-centeredness, organizational capacity and productivity, accessibility management, service delivery improvement performance, as well as operations management. As I said, I just wanted to bring that out because it was a useful research that the department undertook. But in terms of the rest of the slides, Chair, it's just additional reports or information that we are giving on what we have already presented before. So with your permission, Chair, I will end the presentation here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation, colleagues. Let's move to the next presentation by the PSC. I have been told by Masi that the commissioners here in our midst, Commissioner Mavuso, Ngwenya, Commissioner McMahon, and so just before your presentation has been deployed to represent the commission, because usually I always give the chair, if not the deputy chair or any commissioner that have been given that task, to speak as opening remarks, then also the presenter. Thank you.
Greetings to you, Honorable Chair, to all the honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, colleagues present here. Let me say all protocol observed. My name is Nancy Ngwenya. I'm the commissioner from the Public Service Commission. I was thinking that my chairperson would be here. Nonetheless, Honorable Chair, we...
I am here, but I think you can go ahead. Thank you.
No, Chair, let me greet and I'll hand over to you. We are grateful of this opportunity, Honorable Chair, to come and present the handbook of the Public Service Commission, as well as the code of conduct that we have drafted in our own initiative as the commission.
So I am happy that the chairperson is here. But before the presentation can be made, I would love to request one of the committee members, who is Commissioner LV, just to give us a background on the rationale. Why did we then take the initiative as the Public Service Commission to draft this draft handbook and the code of conduct that we are presenting to your good selves this morning? I'm going to hand over to the chair to greet, and then Commissioner Sizani will take over, and then our presenter. And an apology is further tendered on behalf of our DG, who has a competing engagement this morning and could not be here. Hence, we have got our chief director, Mr. Siya Sanga, who is going to take us through the presentation. Chairperson, let me observe protocol and hand over to you.
Thank you very much. Greetings to the honorable members, the chairperson, and fellow commissioners, the DG, DPSA, and her colleagues. And we really appreciate this opportunity to once again come before you to present this code of conduct, which is meant to assist in your work of trying to craft mechanisms of further exercising, your overseeing the work of the commission itself. But we do have capable members who have been assigned by the commission to lead this process, supported by the OPSC. So I hand over to Commissioner Sizani.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Honorable members, the chairperson of the Public Service Commission, fellow commissioners, the DG of DPSA and officials of DPSA, I also want to greet you. Commissioner Sizani, who is a resident commissioner for the province of the Eastern Cape and also a caretaker commissioner for the Western Cape province. And Chairperson, we, as you are aware, we are a single commission for the Republic. As we present our work before the commission, it's a work that we present to Parliament, but we are also mindful of the fact that the same work is supposed to be presented with the legislatures, of course, through the processes of the NSOP when it comes to the handbook and the code of conduct that we're presenting. Just a brief background, Honorable Chairperson. As you are aware that the Public Service Commission is one of the oldest institutions in our country, having started in 1912, but the commission that we are about now is the one that started in 1999, and that is 24 years old now, because this commission is the one that was doing the work that the DPSA is now doing, the work of regulating the space of the public service in terms of setting norms and standards in the public service, negotiation of salaries, and all those things. Until such time, this commission became a constitutional body that has an oversight function now, and this oversight function is actually assisting also Parliament and legislators in doing their own oversight. But I just want to acknowledge this, Honorable Chairperson, that this commission has been operating in a vacuum. When it started in 1999, as you are aware, the Constitution says Parliament is the one that appoint commissioners. If we look at Section 196 of the Constitution, and legislatures as well with respect to provincial commissioners. But when they started, there were no frameworks in place. As a result, it was said that the conditions of service at the time of commissioners will just apply those that are applicable to officials, especially SMS members, senior management service in the public service. But it's surprising that it was not implemented in full. There are other benefits that are applicable to members of the senior management service that are not applicable to commissioners. But since there was no framework, it was agreed that that will be the framework that will be used until such time a framework is developed. Commissioners, members of parliament are aware that after they've done their work of nominating a commissioner, the administrative part of things are handled by the president in terms of making sure that letters to the appointment letters are issued, commissioners are able to work. But the president can never issue a letter until parliament appoints a commissioner, recommend it and take a resolution in parliament. So we take it that the parliament is the employer in this case. And we're also mindful of the fact that there is no way that the Public Service Commission itself can develop its own conditions of service and code of conduct. Those are instruments that are put by the employer. Employer in this case being parliament, and if there's something administratively after that, that needs to be done, it has to be done by the president. But the president cannot jump parliament. Parliament is the one that is supposed to decide on these matters. That is why we are bringing this work before parliament. We are aware also that the gaps that I've mentioned before also include the non-compliance of a section of the Constitution, which is Section 219, subsection 5 of the Constitution, that talks to the conditions of service that are supposed to be managed by the Remuneration Commission. That includes all constitutional bodies. I want to believe even Parliament, they is the commission that recommends the conditions of service of members. So there is no way that the commission itself could have concluded this work, because it is not its work. It is the work of Parliament, but we are just being proactive in making sure that we develop something and present it before our principals, as we are doing now. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members.
Thank you, Chair. I would then request Mr. Kiyose to beam the presentation and present to the honorable members of the committee. Thank you, Commissioner Elby.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioners. Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members of the committee, my chairperson and commissioners and colleagues. We are presenting on the handbook for members of the Public Service Commission, as well as the Code of Conduct. We have structured the presentation to follow the order of the sections and chapters in the handbook, which then appears as our outline. Commissioner has outlined in terms of the background and the rationale, which really we indicate that the Commission has developed this handbook with a view to assisting the employer in terms of coming up with and developing a framework for the determination of the conditions of service of commissioners. The handbook does provide a guide in terms of various conditions of service, issues of acceptance of office, issues of remuneration and benefits, and other conditions related. It therefore also does seek to ensure that there is some level of uniformity in the provision of service benefits. It is thus therefore presented to the Portfolio Committee for approval and support in this regard. Similarly, the Code of Conduct provides for regulation of conduct and behavior in the workplace and associates our institution, the Commission, with high standards of ethics and conduct as enshrined in our Constitution. We then just reflect on the legislative framework that makes provisions for how the processes in terms of remuneration and conditions for commissioners regulated through the Constitution. Section 196 firstly provides for the establishment of the Commission as well as the appointment of commissioners. Section 219 does provide that legislation and frameworks for determining the salaries, allowances and benefits of any commission would then be so determined, as well as an establish of an independent commission to make recommendation regarding these issues. In addition, the Public Service Commission Act provides for the regulation of the commission, including conditions of appointment and remuneration of commissioners. We also do highlight in this slide that we have the Public Service Act that then provides for regulation of conditions of employment for members of the public service. And this area becomes relevant in view of one of the rationale or challenges that has been identified in terms of a legislative disjuncture where while commissioners are appointed and their processes should be regulated in terms of the Public Service Commission Act, most of their conditions of service are actually determined in line with the dispensation for senior management service who are actually appointed in terms of the Public Service Act instead. This does provide a kind of a risk in terms of oversight, noting that the role of the Commission is really to monitor and oversee the public service in ensuring effectiveness and efficiency, but also, however, that the fact that these are also not fully applied. For an example, there is the lack of annual salary progression where commissioners are concerned, and this leaves commissioners at really their very first entry-level salaries for their entire terms, whether a commissioner stays one term, which is a five-year period, or even 10 terms, they will remain at that entry-level salary because of the lack of the progression. It has been noted, members, the issue around the responsibility lying with the employer in the case of Parliament and the legislatures to set the conditions of service. However, the Commission has taken the initiative, noting the gap in this regard. We then focus on the various sections that the handbook covers and just outline what exactly is contained within there. We do look at the scope of appointment and noting the appointment in terms of terms and number of years of the term of commissioners to serve, 5 years, renewable for one additional term. Note that commissioners serving a term of office shall not occupy or hold office in any political party or organization to make sure that independence is maintained. And also that commissioners shall not perform any remunerative work outside their duties and public office without the consent of the president, as well as seeking prior approval to engage in any other activities, such as serving on boards and any other activities other than the work of the commission. So they would need that prior approval in such instances. We then reflect on a section around acceptance of office and note that upon appointment and acceptance of office, commissioners' relocation expenses may be covered in the instances where the commissioners have to be relocated from their homes to the seat of office. And these costs in terms of transportation and travel shall therefore be arranged by the office in line with applicable policies in terms of supply chain and so on. Also, in the event that accommodation is not readily available, a hotel accommodation may be provided not exceeding a period of 30 days. And this would include storage and related costs. Noting that the members, though, shall take full responsibility to look for such accommodation. then the area around provision of administrative support and tools of trade, the handbook does note that commissioners shall be provided with an office in terms of applicable norms and standards and policies. They'll be provided with support staff in terms of assisting them in the carrying out of their duties, tools of trade, including laptops and equipment to enable communication and enable uninterrupted carrying out of duty shall be provided, and that members may claim for reimbursement for actual costs. And here we are really referring to out-of-pocket expenses in terms of the use of internet and data and so on. The area around travel, the handbook provides that travel for the members shall be determined in terms of policies, noting though and ensuring that cost effectiveness should be put in mind when travel arrangements are being made. The handbook also provides that it is mandatory for members of the commission to own a reliable vehicle in terms of utilizing for official journeys. And members shall be fully responsible for all running and maintenance costs in this regard, and therefore may not participate in the subsidized motor transport scheme. However, the handbook notes and provides for rental vehicles in cases of very bad road conditions and long distance journeys, as you would find in many areas where commissioners have to make their visits, whether they're going for inspections and engagements and so on, or going and visiting other provinces, for example. International travel, if essential and in the interest of the commission, but also subject to the availability of funds, may be undertaken. And this shall not exceed 14 days, considering the official duties of the commissioners should not be compromised. Other conditions then would be provided for, such as a commissioner may be accompanied by not more than two support staff, as well as other conditions in terms of reasonable accommodation and daily allowances shall then be applicable and payable. Accommodation and official residence. The handbook provides that a commissioner may occupy a state-owned residence for official purposes. Such residence will be then, application for such will be channeled through the Department of Public Works, and minimum rentals as determined by the department shall then be payable. The commissioner shall also in such instances be personally liable for signing of lease agreements. They would be liable for any loss and damage to property in those instances. In terms of remuneration, the handbook provides for the determination of remuneration in accordance with the Constitution, Section 2195, which provides that national legislation must establish frameworks for determining the salaries, allowances, and benefits of members of any commission. In this regard, our handbook then refers to an independent commission making recommendation concerning these issues, salaries, allowances, and benefits for commissioners that shall then be approved by the president. We also note the composition of the remuneration package, which then may be mirrored in terms of the composition relating to the senior management services. The issue of pension benefits. The members of the commission are required to become members of the pension fund, and those who have contributed to the government employees pension fund before joining need not then withdraw their benefits. The handbook deals with the issue of performance evaluation, but also trying to address and introduce the annual salary progression that has been identified as one of the challenges and gaps, and notes that where the employer is satisfied with the performance of a commissioner for a period of at least 12 consecutive months in a financial year, then a notch progression shall be granted. This does carry the implication that performance evaluation systems and processes that are appropriate may then require to be developed in order to make the determinations around performance and satisfaction. In terms of termination of service, the pension benefits of a commissioner shall be calculated in terms of pension rules and regulation. All leave credits due shall be paid out, and the commissioner shall also be entitled on the in the event of their retirement to full benefits, which would include leave gratuity, full pension benefits, and the gratuity payment terms paid in terms of a specified formula, as the handbook provides for such a formula. Now, coming to the code of conduct, just reflected in this one slide, we do note that the code of conduct is developed to regulate conduct and behavior of the members of the Public Service Commission in the workplace. It does clarify the mandate, values and principles, but also links these and the institution with high standards of professional ethics. Really, the purpose being to set norms and standards for ethically good and acceptable behavior of the commission and regulate the general conduct as members execute on the mandate of the institution. It also outlines conditions on which a commissioner may be removed from the office by the president, with a view ultimately to ensure that commissioners behave in socially acceptable and respectful manner. In conclusion, Chairperson and members, we reiterate the development of the handbook with a view to supporting the committee, the parliament, legislatures, in terms of providing a framework for determining the service conditions and remuneration, and hence a request and the tabling, therefore, for the committee to consider approval and support of the handbook. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you very much, colleagues. Honorable members, those are the two presentations, one from the department and also the presentation of the PSC. Now is the time to take hands of both presentations, honorable members, and I think that you have noted issues on the presentation. I will start with Honorable Ntuli. I'm noting hands first, Honorable Ntuli. Then Honorable Shriver. Followed by Honorable Kibi, then Honorable Notnahal, Honorable Komane, then Honorable Manisi. There are no four. Okay, yeah. Honorable Nduli, followed by Honorable Shriver, and also I'm noting what you have written on the chart, your unstable connection, and then Honorable Kibi, Honorable Notnahal, Honorable Komane, Honorable Manil. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Greetings to everyone on the platform. Chairperson, just two questions for the department, DPSA. The first one is about the employment of persons with disabilities. I wanted to check with DPSA as to how far they've improved employing people with a disabilities. And to check maybe with the Department of Women, Youth and People with Disabilities if there is that database that can assist them moving forward. That is the in terms of the people with disabilities. Then the second one is about the lifestyle audit. On this one, I know the portfolio committee has been sounded like a scratch record on this one. We've been asking many questions in various ways. Now, I wanted to check with DPSA to say what can be improved with regards to the slow implementation of the lifestyle audit in future. And again, knowing that DPSA is the overseer and also monitoring the departments, governmental departments in this regard, are there any disciplinary measures that they've put down, not for the people that are perpetrators, but for the departments, so that the departments can speed up such processes? Are there any kind of disciplinary measures? Or they just leave it to departments, they'll report as and when it suits them. That's all for DPSA. And then for PSC, I think I've got, checking with my notes, I think I've got two questions as well. In terms of accommodation, to say when establishing the note, the handbook, how can it be sort of applied to say these commissioners, the commissioners that have got no accommodation, or the commissioners that have been relocated, for them to get the subsidy of some, but I understand that this can be linked with public works, but we know that we all know that public works at the end of the day will be charging. So who will subsidize that commissioner, and is that affected? How can that be affected in the logbook? And two, in terms of the removal of an incapacitated commissioner due to injury or ill health, I think that one was not clear as to which policy are they referring to. Because for me, if a commissioner was still in the office and got ill to an extent that he or she can't execute the work, there should be a kind of assistant that it must be sort of rendered. I don't know, but it was not clear. Let me say so. It was not clear. Or else with the permanent, you can be, we are using cars here, and there can be a permanent disability that doesn't allow you to work anymore. So, if they can open it up so that we understand as to what will happen, because that one is very sensitive. And in terms of car rentals, can that one be clear too? That if a commissioner is relocated to Mpumalanga from Eden Cape, there'd be that sort of assistance in terms of transportation. I wanted also to check the rationale between renting a car and subsidizing a commissioner to buy a relevant car for the work. Thank you. Oh, lastly, Chair, in terms of the code of conduct, I wanted also to check that for me it wasn't clear the several conduct that we are referring to. Of course, there are things. I mean, yeah, there are issues that are known to be strictly prohibited for work. I'm making an example. If somebody is under the influence of liquor in the office, they're absconding from work. I mean, there can be more. As to if it can be clear as to say this and that, because people do things, and at the end of the day, hence it's not illustrated, they'll have that to take that particular department or PSC itself to to court. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Ntuli and Honorable Schreiber.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think I'm still with you. Good morning, colleagues, and to the presenters. Chair, I must record my concern about two specific aspects of this handbook, the PSC handbook. The first one is clause 7.4, and I would like to get a very specific response on this, please, because, Chair, this clause says that commissioners shall be entitled to a diplomatic passport for visits abroad and may be accompanied by support staff of not more than two employees. Now, I have checked in terms of the policy around diplomatic passports, and it does not extend to the Public Service Commission. So I'd like to understand the legal basis for allowing public service commissioners to obtain diplomatic passports, given that they are not diplomats. And secondly, I'd like to know whether this is a new clause, whether this is a new mechanism, or whether diplomatic passports have previously also been issued to public service commissioners. I think this is a very alarming clause, and I'd like specific answers to those two questions. Is it new, and what is the legal basis? Chair, then the second thing to highlight is the issue of accommodation and clause 8.1, or really chapter 8 of this handbook, which outlines that public service commissioners may occupy state-owned residences. Now, again, the practice has been that these residences are available to members of the executive. I would like to know whether public service commissioners have previously occupied state-owned residences, in terms of which policies and laws and rules did they do so, and also whether this is a new insertion, and also, again, what is the legal basis for this? Because public service commissioners earn a substantial salary, and they have all the benefits that are outlined in this handbook, and I do not understand why taxpayers and the people of South Africa must then also fork out for accommodation for them. This is not how it works in any other work environment. If you need to relocate for work, then you do so at your own cost. And as we saw, there is substantial benefits here in terms of relocation. So I find this an absolutely unacceptable provision, along with the granting of diplomatic passports for people who are obviously not diplomats. And I would like very clear and specific answers on whether these clauses are new and in terms of which laws and rules the people of South Africa can be expected to hand out these passports and residences to public service commissioners. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Schreiber. Honorable Kibi. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to you. Good morning to the Honorable Members and to the departments here. Honorable Chair, let me welcome the presentations, both of them, and also say, Honorable Chair, I'm relatively covered by the questions by Honorable Julie, especially on the lifestyle audit and also people with a disability. I'm also covered on the second presentation about the handbook. Honorable Chair, my question would be to the first presentation on professionalization framework. Which pillars of the national framework towards professionalization the public sector are implemented? Who monitors those implementations of the national framework, Honorable Chair, if one can get the clarity on that one? Also on HOD performance management system, approved HOD performance systems for implementation consider Auditor General's concerns with regards to ensuring officials acting for more than 6 months signed performance agreement of accounting officers. And my last one, Honorable Chair, is on integrated financial management system. How long and how many years has the integrated financial management system been introduced? Why such a delay in the implementation of the system? Because one feels that really it's been a long time now. Those are my questions, Honorable Chair, and I thank you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Honorable Kibi. Honorable North Nahal.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, and good morning to everybody on the platform. I was also covered with some of the previous questions by the members, but I would also like to ask the following questions. My first question will be to DBSA, and that will be on the leverage cloud technologies. What has been achieved with regards to digitalization of the administration services in the public sector? Then my next question will be on the incorporation of professional ethics into the compulsory induction program. And my question there is going to be, does incorporation of professional ethics into the compulsory induction program change the attitude of those enrolled in the course? Then my next question will be on the handbook, and that would be the following. I would just like to know, on the remuneration of commissioners determined in accordance with the section 2195 of the Constitution. So my question is going to be, as you correctly point out, that the remuneration of commissioners will be determined in accordance with section 2195 of the Constitution, but also linking remuneration to introducing an annual salary progression based on salary satisfactory performance. Do you envisage the committee to appraise commissioners and recommend to the independent commission to consider a notch progression over and above the determined increase recommended to the president by the independent commission? Please provide further details. I thank you, Chair. That will be my questions.
Thank you, Honorable Notnachal, Honorable Komane.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, colleagues, members of PSC and the DPSA. Let us, Chair, welcome the presentations and pose the following questions, especially to the DPSA Chair. I want to know with concern, Chairperson, not achieving the target at this time of the sixth parliament. So it is a very worrying point, and we want to get it from the DPSA whether these targets would be met by the end of this term. And Chair, again, there seems to be no willingness by the department in terms of employing people with disabilities. So one would then check whether the departments are aware or whether the DPSA have engaged maybe with the Department of Women, Youth and People Living with Disabilities to can get the database of the unemployed people living with disabilities so that this can be of assistance when employment is done through different departments. And then in terms of the lifestyle audits, Chair, one would then ask, because in the presentation they indicated that there are departments that have not done their lifestyle audits. Why are they not doing them? Although partly it was covered in the presentation, but because it was a directive that they should do them. What then would then be the time frame given? Because others were linked to challenges of not understanding, and so what is the time frame that they would be implementing those things? And then what is the salary level of the ethic officers? And what is their capacity to investigate the senior managers? Because in terms of the presentation given, it was not very clear. And then we also note with a very serious concern, Chair, because even the DG has highlighted the capacity challenges in the DPSA. We still also want to record that it is very worrisome for the department like DPSA to have the capacity challenges, which they still record and inform the committee about now. And Chair, coming to the framework by the PSC, you know, I cannot overemphasize what was raised by Honorable Schreiber. But Chair, I don't know, maybe let me not overemphasize it, but I echo the same sentiments with him pertaining to the commissioner's diplomatic passports. And also, why must the commissioners be allocated residence? Because they are employed, they must carry their own, their costs for their own accommodation. And Chair, one would then ask, because in the framework that they have explained to us, they raised an issue of being finished with the tools of trade, which is okay. But then why must they claim for reimbursement for data and airtime? Because they've got tools of trade aligned with the public services. And then upon appointment, they are expected to be owning cars, Chair. Why must they also be rented cars? Because that was one of the key issues when we had to employ them. We knew that they can run from one point to the other. So why must they be rented cars? And then, Chair, lastly, regarding the removal of a commissioner from service, do they have the policy on incapacity, or are they referring to that one of the public servants? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Komane, Honorable Maneli. Thanks, Chairperson, and greetings to honorable members and the presenters. Chairperson, I think I've got a number of questions as well. Probably let me start with the handbook. Maybe, Chair, if it can be explained to us as to how does the Commission see the process panning out between them having envisaged, how they envisage the process to go when they have salary increases that are recommended to the President by an independent commission, and yet they expect a notch progression from Parliament through the performance evaluation by the Portfolio Committee. If that could be explained to us, Chairperson. Also, coming to the department, in terms of the ethics infrastructure, if you can be told as to what has been the impact of all the interventions that were introduced in the public sector with regards to ethics as a way of instilling a culture of good ethical practices. My next question, Chair, will be, what is the level of compliance on non-compliance letters issued by the DPSA? I believe, Chairperson, these are not entirely highlighted in the presentation. And my last question will be, what are the causes of the low level of compliance by those that are below senior level management? And also, how effective are its disclosures? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, honorable members. And we have covered many questions to the two presentations. However, I will then give the department
to respond to the questions from honorable members, with mindful that the DG have left this meeting. In fact, she has requested that she will release her to join the cabinet meeting. So
I'm back, Chair. Apologies. Back.
Okay. The questions, I think they have noted from the department, and you will respond to all your questions, and immediately the PSC will come in. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have colleagues from EXCO, all the DDGs and some chief directors, relevant chief directors in the meeting. So I'm going to ask them to answer the questions, and then I'll come back to just pull everything together. The questions from Honorable Ntuli, there's one on employment of persons with disabilities. DDG Linda will handle that. And then there's another one on database to assist with recruitment. Is there a database from Department of Women, DDG Linda, to also handle that? There's question on lifestyle audits. All the questions on lifestyle audits, I don't have to read them. Dr. Solomon is going to handle them together with those that relates to questions on DC measures. Dr. Solomon will respond to those. Questions on the professionalization of the public service, which are the pillars and the contract, the HOD contract. Nico will answer those. That's acting DDG, HRM and D. IFMS question and other IT related question. Zaid, acting DDG, EGISM will answer those questions. There's one on cloud technologies as well. And then again, Dr. Solomon, there's one on ethics induction. What is the impact? And then there's a question I will take on whether we will meet targets for the term. Have we engaged with Department of Women Youth to get database? I think that one already have allocated. Lifestyle audits, why some departments are not doing audits? Okay, so that's Dr. Solomon. Salary level and capacity of investigators, Dr. Solomon as well. Capacity challenges raised by DG, worrisome. Those two questions, I'll handle them later. The last block of questions from Honorable Manelli, it goes straight to Dr. Solomon, all the questions that were asked. With that, with your permission, Chair, I would ask to request that DDG Linda starts, followed by Dr. Solomon, followed by Zaid, and followed by Nico. There's other members of EXCO who are here. If they want to maybe add more information, I think they will indicate. Thank you, Chair. Did you hear, Linda? Did you hear, Linda?
Yes, DG. Thank you. The percentage of persons with disabilities appointed in the DPSA is above the 2% national target, currently sitting at 2.2%, and it has been above the 2% target for the past 3 years. At this point, we do not have challenges with appointment of persons with disabilities. Of course, our intention is to exceed this 2.2%, because if you look at the actual numbers against the total staff establishment, it's 8 people out of about 380. So our intention, of course, is to have more persons with disabilities appointed, not just for the sake of numbers, but to ensure that we provide opportunities to them for employment. And no, there is no database from the Department of Women. Departments are required as part of the Employment Equity Act to put in place their own affirmative action measures to improve the appointment of persons with disabilities as well as women So as part of those affirmative action measures, departments must identify for themselves how they are going to ensure that they attract those two groups. And one of the ways is to send adverts to institutions that work with persons with disabilities. So as the department, we also do that. When we have posts, we make those institutions aware so that they can pass on the information to their members. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. I take it that I need to respond to the following questions. The first question was the question by the Honourable Mantuli on what can be done to improve lifestyle audits. Now, one must keep in mind that lifestyle audits is quite a recent development in the public service where we had to establish first the legislation, get all the infrastructure in place, get the system in place for the financial disclosures. And so it's quite a recent system that still needs to mature. And this means that there must be ongoing training, especially on the different steps of lifestyle audits. The one is the lifestyle review process, and then the second one, the lifestyle investigation process. And there we got a lot of assistance with not only the Canadian government, but also from the SIU and also from the World Bank and the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. So that need to continue. And the second part was the issue of stabilizing the cohort of ethics officers. And that we've done now with the change in the legislation where we indicated that you don't only need to designate the ethics officer, but that one can now also appoint ethics officers. And this addresses the issue where in certain departments every year, the ethics officers were then reappointed and new people got designated to be ethics officers. And then the issue was that they were not trained the previous year, so they cannot do the lifestyle audits. And that gave us some challenges, but this will now be addressed with the new changes. Then the other thing that can be done to improve the lifestyle audits is also like we've done from the beginning of the year, where we come to the portfolio committee and then indicate who's those departments who do not conduct the lifestyle audits. And that had a significant impact by then the next day we would get calls and ask how to come and please assist those departments who still do not comply. And then based on that, we saw the uptick in departments taking then this serious. So that today we only have four national departments, defense, military, veterans, public works and infrastructure and transport, that is from national level not conducting lifestyle audits. And then on national provincial level, the Eastern Cape, Free State, Gauteng, Limpopo, North, West, where there's certain departments that still need to do lifestyle audits. Honourable Ntuli, you also indicated what disciplinary measures exist for lifestyle audits. Now, the same measures that currently is there for all the breaches of the code of conduct is still valid for lifestyle audits. So if any individual is not complying with Regulation 22 or the public service regulations, which deals with lifestyle audits, then that is misconduct and it can be disciplined by the department as taking the normal route. And this is in the hands of the departments because the DPSA cannot discipline other other departments' employees. So what we've done to make sure that there is disciplinary action is by following up with these departments to ask them what do they do, what steps do they take, and then also requesting our minister to draft the non-compliance letters to the EAs, which also proved to be quite effective. Honourable Noordnagel, you requested the or you asked the question, does the integration of ethics into the IPC change the attitude of those that enrolled into the course? Now, This is the first course that we came across where public servants actually started to do the course voluntary, paying for it by themselves, without it being a compulsory course, with I think it's close to 100,000 of public servants already enrolled into this course. And the main aim of the course when it was developed by the MSG was to look at the behavioral change aspect as one of the objectives. So the course is very practical. It has examples that is based on real life experience, and that tries to make those that enroll to reflect on their current behavior and to provide alternative and correct options for wrong choices. So it exposed the individuals to the rules and the regulations, but going further to explain what would your impact be if you'd make the wrong choice. Why is it wrong? And that is to make it more understanding for the person about the behavioral aspect that they need to look at when they take action in the public service. So although there is no test that is tracking whether there is a direct change of those 100,000 to enrolled, if you look at the Public Service Ethics Culture Survey of 2022, it clearly shows that there is an improvement in terms of the behavior of the ethical aspect of public servants. So then if we look at the question of Honorable Khumane, the Honorable asked the question, some people do, or some departments do comply with lifestyle audits, they conduct that, and others do not. And why are they not doing that? Now, the indication, the general response to this, when we assessed from the different departments why they are slow with the lifestyle audits, was first of all that they do not have the ethics officers in place, which is why it's now important that the appointment of ethics officers is also scrutinized. But we also followed up with reminding departments that in terms of the public service regulations, they need to have ethics officers in place. And then the second most common response was that we do not have the knowledge, the skills, we don't know why or how to do it. And that is why the constant training is so important, and that we also do needs analysis on the ethics officers to understand exactly where the gap is, and to then do a targeted intervention to address that lack of skill. The other reason that I'm not 100% sure if that it's not scientific, but the indication for me, and we will test that next year, is that there is also now currently a withholding of the financial disclosures because some of the employees may be afraid that there will be lifestyle audits done on them. And the reason why I say that is for the last 5 years, we had a 98% submission rate for lifestyle audits or for financial disclosures, which is very or extremely high. And this year was the first year when we had a 2% drop to 96%. And that is for me a red flag, where it may be that some senior managers are now scared to submit their financial disclosures because they know there will be lifestyle audits conducted. We know the names of the 600 and so SMS members who did not comply, and we're following up to understand what is going on there. So, Honorable Khumane, you also asked what is the time frame for the financial or for the lifestyle audits to be completed. We have a full year time frame. So by the end of this financial year, it should be conducted. We recently issued a circular to all national departments and provincial departments, reminding them that by the end of January 2024, We want to know the status of all the lifestyle reviews, lifestyle investigations conducted, and also to have reports on those cases that has been referred for investigations, and those where employees did not submit their financial disclosures, and to request what is the what steps were taken and what the departments are doing regarding that. Honourable Kumani, you also asked what the salary level of the ethics officers. Now, the salary level of ethics officers are not prescribed. That will follow based on the risk assessment that the department does on their own organizational risks, and to see what they need to mitigate those risks and to address those risks. So it's not fixed, but it's based on risk analysis. And then the follow-up question linked to that, Honourable Kumani, was what is the capacity then, based on the salary level and so the ethics officers, to investigate the SMEs? So on this, I can answer that the ethics officers do not investigate at all. They do not have a responsibility to do investigations in the lifestyle audit process. They're only responsible for the lifestyle review process, which is the first part. And then when they do detect, based on the information from the open sources and the sources that's available to them, if they then indicate that there's an anomaly, they then refer that for the departmental investigators, and those investigators will then investigate whether it's SMEs or non-SMEs or whatever the case may be. And the last question was that of the Honourable Maneli, and that is around the ethics infrastructure, where the question was, what is the impact of all the work that we have done so far on good ethical culture? And Honourable Maneli, yeah, I can share the public service survey, the public sector ethics survey that was done independently by the Ethics Institute in May 2022, where they looked at all the areas that the DPSA had a program on. And they looked at that and made an analysis to see whether it had an impact on the ethical culture of the public service. And I can report that there is definitely a move in the right direction, where there's more understanding of the rules and the regulations, but there's also a better application of this in the public service. And the one thing that is also different from this survey is that they tested to see where the organizations have ethics officers to see if that correlates also with good governance, in the sense of tracking whether those departments have good, clean audits from the AG. And they found that there is a direct correlation. So the issues that I can just quickly highlight, but I think I can make this report available to the portfolio committee to have a look at, is the huge increase in the awareness of the code of conduct, that people in the public service understand the policy on gifts, on private work, on sexual harassment, the awareness on the hotline, that there is also awareness now of the ethics infrastructure and on lifestyle audits. And when they've done the research on lifestyle audits, an 89% of public servants that were tested then indicated that they will voluntarily undergo lifestyle audits. So I think the report will address that issue more than what I can do in a few words now, Honourable Maneli. But Honourable Chair, I think that was more or less all the questions directed to me regarding the issue of lifestyle audits of the ethics and integrity infrastructure, and also around discipline management dealing with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Solomon. The next one is Zaid.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. I would speak to two questions. I think the first question was around why such a delay on IFMS and how many years has it been delayed for? I must admit, Chair, that I do not have the exact date that the IFMS project was started, but I think it's something that is factual and we should be able to get to the committee. Let me indicate that we, as the DPSA, of course, we play a supporting role to National Treasury in the implementation of the IFMS. And I think from a delay perspective, we've seen the project go through two phases. The initial phase, of course, being choosing a hybrid or bespoke methodology of development. In other words, there were some components of the IFMS that the project had chosen to build in-house using our own in-house skills. And there are some components that we had chosen to procure from industry. Of course, that was partially implemented, and we found that approach was problematic in terms of allowing the integration, creating additional complexities. There was a review of the IFMS at some point using international bodies to look at the approach and look at the project. There was a change of approach which resulted in a new tender or phase two or version two of IFMS being launched that went out to tender. I think we are currently seeing the challenges in relation to the tendering process and how it impacts on the status of the project. I must also indicate, Chair, that a project of this nature, given the complexities of our financial system and the centralized nature of the financial system, delivering to 161 individual departments from an HR perspective, having to deal with the different legislative requirements in terms of health and education, et cetera, it does give rise to additional complexity. And the big question of internal skills being able to fast track some of the development, I think, comes into question. So it's a complex answer in terms of what has happened and why have we stalled up to now. I think what's important is that the pressure from departments for us to be able to move, or for them to be able to move from a digitalization perspective in terms of the backend processes, has now reached a point that I do believe that Treasury is starting to talk about how we can lift some of the restrictions to allow departments to progress. In the DPSA, we are also looking at certain core components that will enable us to progress, such as e-recruitment and other components. And of course, there are some departments that have been given permission to move ahead. And so we are looking at those technologies and trying to strike that balance between looking at the ginormous project called the IFMS and how it takes us forward, but also making sure that we progress in terms of certain things we are able to do. So I think in terms of the second question around cloud technologies, what has been achieved? I think, Chair, the most obvious achievement, I think, is just looking at the way we are conducting ourselves, our business today here, being able to I'm in the Eastern Cape, the DG and the rest of the team are in Gauteng, and yourselves, I'm not sure where you are, but we are able to have this conversation remotely and work remotely and continue the work of government. And I think most, if not all, departments are able to do the same thing in terms of conducting its business. And I think the savings in terms of the bottom line, in terms of the travel expenditure and all of those other associated costs are just, it's quite impressive what we've been able to do in responding, of course, to COVID and the lockdown. But I think as a spin-off, as a result of that, we are now seeing departments that are starting to use the cloud technologies and have been doing so, before even the DPSA published the directive. Since the directive, I can tell you, Chair and Honorable Members, that we've received compliance reports from some 70 departments that have already used additional cloud technologies. As an example as well, Chair, in the Eastern Cape, what is being reported is that prior to the cloud, they've had serious challenges in relation to the distributed email communication platforms in the province and the fact that the technology was always down because of legacy issues. They are reporting, as the Eastern Cape, the entire province today, having moved to the cloud, that they have zero downtime in terms of email and productivity applications. And so we are seeing the positive results. In the Western Cape, we know of cloud technology deployments. In fact, in all provinces, we are seeing this, including in the Northwest. So I think while we speak about anecdotal evidence now around the improvement in terms of digitalization as a result of cloud, One of the things that the BPSA is doing towards, as with the deadline of the end of the financial year, is to then go to individual departments and assess the progress, or at least get a sense of the progress that they've made in terms of digitalization, in order to develop a comprehensive report for the public service to understand where we've moved to in terms of digitalization. And as we move, as we take on that additional work into the coming financial years, we're also looking, Chair and colleagues, to create digitalization indicators for the public service so that we can have a barometer and try to understand where the different provinces are, where the different departments are in their digitalization journey, and also allow us to set targets across the board from a digitalization perspective. So, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, DG, those are the questions. I think I've answered them. You will indicate if there's anything else.
Thank you. The last responses from Nico. Nico, please be brief.
Good morning, DG, Chairperson and Honourable Members. I'll be very brief. I'll go straight to the questions that were asked. The first question, in fact, let me group all of them so that I'm able to be quicker than the colleagues. I think the main question is, do we work with the Department of Women on our initiatives? So we do work with them on a number of initiatives. We have partnered with them on a recent program called the United Nations Development Program Gender Seal, which seeks to address challenges faced by public sector institutions in addressing gender parity and equality in their public services. And we have continuously partnered with the department in monitoring reports for compliance on the designated groups, those of women, youth, and people living with people with disabilities across the public service. So we have also suggested that in terms of the Regulation 65, Subsection 6, that when you advertise a position, you are not allowed to unfairly discriminate against or prohibit any suitably qualified person or employee to apply. So in line with the preference given under affirmative action measures, we do suggest to departments, and we do monitor them with, in partnership with the Department of Women, in disability rights organization, to check where we can increase the visibility of designated or groups applying into positions across the public service, as well as to assist the departments themselves to respond to those the needs for ensuring that there is economic opportunities for the designated groups. The next major issue, DG and Chairperson, is that what were the delays in the implementation of the revisions to the PMDS? Honourable Chairperson, we don't consider what we have to have been delays, because we work on a 3-year cycle. And in terms of the work that we're currently doing, we have linked the changes to the acting appointments, as well as the challenges that the Auditor General have highlighted for us. So the PMDS currently requires that if a person acts for more than 3 months, they must revise their PAs or their performance agreements to incorporate those new responsibilities. And we have included those, and currently we are revising, we have revised the PMDS for HOD, for HODs, which is currently being piloted. The DGDPSA participated in it earlier, last week, Friday, as part of the pilot itself. And any changes that can only, that come out of that system can only be introduced at the end of the 3-year cycle, which means that from the 1st of April next year, we will be able to introduce the new changes. Lastly, Honourable Chairperson, is that both the Minister and the AG, or second lastly, both the Minister and the AG have asked us to assess the impact of our policies, directives and regulations that we issue on the service delivery, on the functionality of government, as well as how the public views our services. So we are building the capacity, as Madhuda explained earlier, on the early warning system. We are building the capacity to monitor and evaluate the impact and how and improve our capability to enforce compliance across the public service on all the things that we're all the norms and standards that we've issued. So this includes the monitoring of acting appointments additional to the structure, expenditure on overtime, and adherence to PMDS prescripts so that we can be able to measure productivity of public servants. So we have taken an overall and integrated approach to addressing the concerns that were raised by the AG of South Africa, so that we are able to deal with all the challenges. But beyond that, we are also working on a new human capital strategy that will map the whole value chain of human resources across the public service, including starting from the strategy and planning for human resources, looking at the operational context that shape the environment that we function in, how we recruit, how we onboard people in terms of...
Nico, please move towards closure.
Inductions and so forth, how we make them, most importantly, we reward and recognize people to incentivize the colleagues. Lastly, there was a request that I speak to the professionalization framework. We have 5 pillars in the professionalization framework, which speak to recruitment and selection, how we improve the recruitment processes, the selection processes, and there are some exciting things that are being introduced there and which will be showcased in terms of the new proposals in the professionalization framework directive. The second pillar is the one on induction and onboarding, so that we're able to reorientate public servants that are within the system, that we induct people correctly, that we onboard people correctly. There is the third one is about planning and performance management, the third pillar on how to measure the performance of public servants, how we link the individual performance to that of the institution. And then the next one, which is pillar 4, is continuous learning and professional development, which speaks to how all of those first 3 pillars are supposed to contribute towards our human resource development plans in the public service, so that we address the skills challenges, so that we move away from appointments additional to the structure and the skills money that we spend, the development money that we spend in development, skills development, actually speaks to the sectors and so forth. And lastly, is the pillar on career progression of HODs and career incidents, which speaks to the hopper, as it were, and the areas that link to the heads of department. Thank you, honorable members and chair. And
thank you, Nico. Chairperson, the last 2 issues, there was a question on whether we're going to achieve the targets. And I do want to say, Chairperson, that as we reported, all our targets are on track to be achieved. Of course, we have different dependencies. The target that relates to legislative amendments, now we have done everything we needed to do as DPSA. Our dependency now is the parliamentary process, so we depend on the parliamentary process. Parliament has indicated that this legislation would be completed, would be finalized by end of March, so we are waiting on that dependence. That's just one example, but we are on track with all our targets. And we have put in place mechanisms to ensure that we achieve these targets within the current term of MTSF. So I do want to assure the committee on that one. We review our performance on a monthly basis to ensure that we do not lose some of the staff, or we miss some of the performance issues. The second comment was on capacity of the DPSA. I think, Chair, maybe even next year you would like to come back to the committee and really talk about what are these capacity issues that we are dealing with as TPSA. Firstly, for the budget, that for the mandate that we have, which is such a broad mandate, we have a very little budget. Our budget is around 500 million rands, and there is so much expectation in terms of roles and responsibilities from TPSA. But secondly, there is also the coordination work that we do, and we are expected at times to deliver on things that are supposed to be delivered by departments. And yet, from a mandate point of view, we are a coordinating mechanism in relation to those particular issues. The last issue relates to just the specialist skills that we need in the department that we do not have. And we understand that we do not have funding currently in the MTF, in the MTF process for those, we have to reprioritize internally. And if you think about specialist skills like remuneration specialists, we deal with wage issues in the public service, but we do not have sufficient number of remuneration specialists that we have in the system. We deal with issues that relate to research, and we don't have sufficient numbers of researchers in the system that we can utilize as TPSA. Those are just some of the examples I'm bringing to your attention. We process lots of data, but we do not have data analysts in the organization and data scientists in the organization to assist us in terms of processing that data and analyzing it and et cetera. So, and the current structure, we are also limited by the current structure that we have currently in the department. But as and when we have vacancies, for those at SMS level, at least we are able to relook at vacancies and introduce new roles to close some of the gaps that we have. But at non-SMS level, we cannot do that because of established labor relations protocols in terms of staff below SMS and the PSCBC resolutions and rules. So those are some of our challenges that we are facing, but we still have to perform within the context of those challenges, and we do give it our best in terms of performance. But I would like to come back to the committee and really open up our books in terms of the challenges that we experience and some of the interventions that we have put in place, which are not sufficient, because some of these issues really require putting in more resources to enable a development of systems that are efficient and sustainable. Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity.
Thank you very much, DG, and your team. And I'm giving them the PSC.
Thank you very much.
Sorry for that. Before the PSC. Chair?
Yes, Honorable Dooley.
Yeah, before the PSC, Chairperson, I think Dr. Salmon didn't get me well, because I was clear on the lifestyle audit as to what I was talking about. I even said not the perpetrators, but the department, so that they can speed up the processes. And when he was answering me, when he was responding, he said, no, they don't. They can't do the work for the departments. Officially, I didn't say so. So he didn't respond to my question.
DG?
Chair, this question relates exactly to the issue I was just responding to earlier on, related to mandate of the DPSA. We can work up until a certain level. And for us, what we do is we send compliance letters to departments that are not implementing. We send we then escalate via our ministers to their ministers, and we escalate to the portfolio committee by providing reports and indicating the departments that are not complying, with the hope that the portfolio committee can intervene and even call some of these departments to come and explain themselves to the portfolio committee. We do not have authority as DPSA to discipline other departments that are not implementing our directives. It is their own ministers who have authority over their own DGs or their own heads of departments. And we haven't seen a minister who has disciplined or an executive authority who has disciplined a DG for failing to implement some of the directives, including the lifestyle directives, including the discipline management issues that we have been dealing with. So it's a mandate issue. We have no authority as DPSA to go, as a DG of DPSA, I have no authority to go and discipline other DGs or discipline other staff in other departments. I have authority over my department only. I have authority to report the matters to the minister, and then the minister reports the matters to the ministers of those departments, with the hope that those ministers are going to intervene with their DGs. And if it doesn't happen, unfortunately, we rely on writing our compliance letters and doing foresight reports and all those things, but we do not have disciplining powers over other DGs as DPSA. So it's those issues around mandates, roles and responsibilities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, DG. With the response, DSC.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I just want to touch briefly on the issue raised by Honorable Schreiber and the other Honorable Member, I can't remember now, on the implementation of professionalization and the monitoring to make sure that it is done. I do think that we will go far if we begin to look at the ecosystem of accountability and oversight. Hence, as the PSC working with DPSA and the National School of Government in crafting that implementation plan, we've started bringing in AG. We've started bringing in the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation to say, let this become institutionalized in the performance agreements, in the formatting of them, and the PSC will continue doing the oversight over this as it is its constitutional mandate on behalf of Parliament. So I do think that at a certain point, we may have to have a conversation with those departments, even if they might be reporting elsewhere on certain things, and have everybody else so that this becomes institutionalized in its implementation. It becomes part of the, performance agreements as well as performance targets of departments. On the other issues of the code of conduct and the rules book, we do have our committee members who have been seized with this. I think I'll give them to answer the specific questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of the Public Service Commission and the Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee. We want to appreciate the constructive comments that we have received from the honorable members, as we have indicated that this is a draft and a proposal that we are submitting for further consideration. I am going to answer on the issue of permanent incapacity as the question was posed, and then hand over to my colleagues, Commissioner Mabuso and Commissioner Sizani, to respond on the other questions that have been raised. On the issue of permanent incapacity due to injury or sickness, I think the handbook clearly stipulates in section 10.9.2 subsection C on the procedures that must be applied when a commissioner has been declared as permanently incapacitated. I think it relates there, the subsection Roman figure 1 up to 3, and safely to further indicate to the honorable members that this is in line with the stipulation of provision of the Labor Relations Act of 1995 as regulated. I think it's Schedule 8, if I'm not mistaken. The other commissioners will then elaborate on the issues of accommodation, because it is also clearly stated on the procedures in Section 8 of the handbook. May I, through your permission, Chair, hand over to Commissioner Mavuso, Commissioner Sizani, and then Commissioner Mavuso, and then back to our Chair. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I hope you allow me to come in.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. I think when we started the presentation, we did say that the work that we're doing is the work to assist the employer in putting proper frameworks in place, because we believe that any institution cannot be allowed to operate in a vacuum. We cannot wake up and when the members of parliament want to take action, they find that no friends. In fact, they may not behave the way you would expect them to do according to what the Constitution provides, that they should be fit and proper persons. We've seen that in other institutions where we thought that people that are appointed in those positions would actually behave in a manner that is acceptable. That is why it is important to assist Parliament to develop these frameworks. Let me deal with the question that talks to the issues of accommodation of commissioners. If we look at how the commissioners are appointed, the Parliament does not, I haven't seen it since 1999, where Parliament or legislatures appoint people at entry levels. They appoint people that had already contributed in the public service, whether in Parliament or in academia or wherever, but they appoint people that had life before, people that had already established their homes wherever they stay. When they apply to serve as commissioners, for me, I don't take it that it's actually an employment as such. It's an application to serve the country, because it's for a particular period of 5 years. That is the same reason why we would take a member of parliament to Cape Town and provide temporal accommodation while this person is working in parliament, because this person has a home and it will be there for the duration of the term for 5 years. We do not expect that member of parliament to start afresh and buy a house in Cape Town. Provinces are huge. If you appoint, for instance, a commissioner in the Eastern Cape that originally comes from Kokstad, and place that commissioner at the seat of government in Bishop, there's no way that that commissioner can commute from Kokstad every day to Bishop for work. But at the same time, you don't expect that commissioner to buy a new house in Bishop while already have a house in Kokstad, which after 5 years, there's not even a guarantee that a term will be renewed. So within 5 years, there is no way that a person can be able to buy a new house in the city where he or she is employed. Let me talk to the issue of the stocks of the houses in public works. I have an opportunity in my other life many years ago of having worked for that department of public works. There are different stocks of houses in public works. There is what we call the portfolio, the prestige portfolio, where you had your houses for your ministers and for your deputy ministers. You would have the stock, which in some cases would be parliamentary villages for members of parliament. There is also a third stock of houses that are available where even junior officials at level 5 in the public service apply to rent those houses. And when we say commissioners must be given official accommodation, we are not referring to the prestige portfolio of ministers that they must be given ministerial houses. But we are saying they must be provided a place to stay if they don't come from that province. We have many examples where commissioners come far away from the seat of government who would ordinarily need some form of accommodation from that stock that is available even for officials of government at lower levels. That is why we are suggesting that they must apply for those houses recommended by the legislatures of parliament that indeed we recruited this member from outside the seat or where he's supposed to serve. So this person will sign a lease agreement with the Department of Public Works and pay the minimum rental that is applicable to everyone, including those that I refer to as lower levels that are getting those houses. I think that's what we meant, and I'm glad members of parliament raised this question as early as now, because at the end of the day, this is their document. They must be able to know what they are trying to put forward in this document. The second question, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, is the issue of a passport, which the chairperson, briefly touched on, which applying for diplomatic passports is the responsibility. In fact, the responsible department is the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. People apply and they get considered. And the people that are carrying diplomatic passports in our country are not only diplomats. We have ministers, we have deputy ministers, we have heads of departments, directors general. They carry this. We even have kings in our country that are carrying these diplomatic passports. They are not only issued to people because they are diplomats. However, there are also service passports, which are official passports that are normally given to certain categories of people working in the public service. But again, even this matter will throw a bet to the hands of members to debate and agree what they want to do, because this is their document. Let me move to the last part, Chairperson, which the members raised. And I like the way the Honorable Member put it when she even said that, because she was talking to the issue of the code of conduct, where she spoke about abscondment, abuse of drugs and alcohol, sometimes poor performance and incapacity. It cannot be allowed that those people should continue to serve while they are not performing at the standard they are required to perform, or they are not behaving in a manner that they are supposed to behave. Of course, if you put a code of conduct, you still have to develop policies that will talk to the code of conduct itself. For example, in the public service, we have a code of conduct generally for employees in the public service. Additionally to that, you have a disciplinary code and procedures in the public service. Additionally, you have departmental policies where they articulate how they're going to apply. So when we are bringing this code of conduct, we are mindful of the fact that there will also be other frameworks that need to be developed in the form of policies, in the form of codes that will be able to tell members of parliament how to conduct. I know that the Constitution in Section 196, subsection 11 of the Constitution deals with the removal from office on ground of misconduct. There is no way that people can be allowed to serve when they are not, their conduct is not at the standard that is required by the Constitution itself and by the members that set, put that Constitution in place. So that is why it is necessary to have this code of conduct. Then there was a question around the proposal that talks to the provision in Section 219, subsection 5 of the Constitution, which service of commissioners must be determined by the Remuneration Committee, a commission. The reason why we're putting two things, we're putting that one because it's a constitutional requirement. It is clear in the Constitution that constitutional bodies' conditions of service should be determined by that committee. But we're also talking of the progression, which members were raising. And I'm glad the members are raising it. The answer to that is that the existing framework is that the conditions of service of commissioners shall not be less favorable than those of the members of the senior management service in the public service. So the proposal that the president may determine on the advice of the Remuneration Commission in terms of the cost of living adjustment only, because that one will deal with the cost of adjustment only. It will not deal with the issue of progression, which talks to the existing framework that they cannot be less favorable. Because presently, commissioners, even if they serve for 5 years or 10 years, as the presentation suggests, they remain on the first notch until they retire after 10 years or they exit the service after 10 years. While on the other side, the existing framework talks something else. So that is why we had put it in. But again, I still throw this in the hands of parliamentarians, and the legislators must decide on this because we were assisting their process. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Sizani. I'm not sure, Honorable Schreiber, if you want to speak before the next speaker from the PSC.
Yeah, Chair, just because the two issues I raised were addressed in the previous submission. So if you'd allow me just briefly to respond, to make a comment. I think it's important for the committee to take note of these responses, specifically related to the handbook and these benefits, because I think we must be aware that we are wading into quite inappropriate territory here from the Public Service Commission. We must remember that the commissioners who are presenting and defending these benefits are conflicted. They themselves are subject to a conflict of interest here because they are the ones who will be benefiting from these things outlined in the handbook. So I think it is highly inappropriate for the custodian of the public service, of the custodian of ethics in the public service, to in this way essentially expose itself and become involved in a flagrant case of a conflict of interest. We could hear from the response the defense of the idea that commissioners must have these multiple residences. Now, frankly, Chair, no one forced anyone to apply to become a public service commissioner. And if you get a job somewhere in this country that will see you moving elsewhere for 5 years, then it is your decision whether you can make arrangements. It is not for the taxpayers of this country to make those arrangements. Similarly, when it comes to this issue of the passports, it is quite disturbing to hear a public service commissioner indicate that we have a broad range of people that are obtaining these passports, apparently in contradiction with what the DIRCO official policy says. But again, mindful of the fact that these very commissioners that are defending the introduction of these benefits are the ones benefiting from it. So I do think that this issue must be taken away from the Public Service Commission. We cannot have a precedent and an example being set by this custodian, supposedly, of professional ethics, who themselves seemingly failed to realize the massive conflict of interest that's playing out in front of this committee today, Chair. I think that is an alarm bell, and I would plead that we move this discussion away from the Public Service Commission and that independent people who are not benefiting from these provisions can soberly look at whether we could possibly justify the provision of state-owned residences, the provision of diplomatic passports, and some of the other things that other members have raised here that will cost the people of South Africa money in a way that is clearly a conflict of interest. I must flag this right now, Chair. I think this process is dangerous. Thank you.
Chair, thank you.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. Comrade Chairperson, I think when PSC responded to the issue of the accommodation, they left my point out because my one was upon the for them, hence they are establishing this handbook to put it clear for the commissioners to get the subsidy for that accommodation. Hence, these commissioners are servicing the country, and we can't penalize them that you are the one who applied from Eastern Cape, and then you were allocated to KZN. So if at the first place they've got that willingness to service the country, let them be treated like other people that are servicing the country. So my question was upon effecting something talking about the subsidy on the accommodation. Of course, they must get accommodation. That's why I was even saying on the cars. Of course, they must get the something should be done on the cars, whether it's the subsidy or whatever, other than renting the car for 5 years. That's where my question was, Chair. The lady didn't respond on that, on effecting that one, because for me, I saw a need of a subsidy for the commissioners on accommodation whilst they are servicing the country. Hence, we are all here. We are staying in the parliamentary villages. We are subsidized. We pay a little bit to public works because we are here to service the people of South Africa. So they are. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Duli. I thought that there were still responses from the PSC, but I've seen the hand of Honorable Komane.
Chair, thank you very much. I did not want to say much, but Chairperson, I think we must desist from making a mistake as a committee. The questions that we raised as members of Parliament and this committee, we raised them for clarity. Hence, I concur that we should note, and then having received the handbook and with the clarity that we have received from the PSC, we need not engage on them. I was tempted by the latter speaker to raise my hand. Can the committee desist from engaging on this? Because we need that clarity. That is a proposal that was presented by the PSC. we as the committee should then have a way of dealing with this thing and maybe coming back to the PSC with solutions or resolutions, or if there is further engagement, we need to call them. But it is premature for us to dwell deeper, and because it will raise so many discussions that are premature. Thank you, Chair. My hand was just for an order to say, let us receive what the PSC has said, given the clarity seekings that they have provided us with, and then we have noted them. We as the committee will then deliberate on that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Koman. And I'm giving a PSC to conclude their responses.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. I'm glad these issues have been raised. All we are saying, we are doing the work and the draft which otherwise would have been conducted by the Parliament as the employer. And for the record, I should say that on around three occasions, we raised the issue of the potential conflict of interest. We raised the issue of asking us to craft conditions for ourselves. And in spite of the fact that we consistently said, please, Parliament, can you handle this? And at a certain point, I think I even said to the chairperson, James, can you get an independent entity to expedite this process so that we are not seen to be conflicted? But the insistence that please craft something so that we work on it. And now we were merely providing explanations, not defenses. The Parliament will see how they slice it, how they create it. Not having us in mind, but having the future office bearers will be appointed into these roles and the expanded role of the PSC that will be given. So to me, I do think that at a certain point, there was even a comment in the media, which was rather unfortunate, I think, from one member, which said, we are in this situation in terms of managing transition of commissioners. Because PSC is not doing its work. It's not coming up with a performance agreement. And again, I responded to say, we cannot, as people appointed by Parliament, do that performance agreement for ourselves. So it's unfortunate that today, precisely because of having cautioned about this, and precisely because we've done the work for assisting the Parliament, when we tried to do the explanations, and it's not the work that was in our hands, we were looking at, people consulting some of the technical people to deal with this, knowing that it was too close to us, and therefore having to raise some of these issues. So when you consider it, have that in mind, that we were merely trying to assist. And I had cautioned on no less than three occasions to say that there is an inherent challenge in even trying to present this draft, because it might be seen as us betting for our own team. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. If the PSC is done with its responses, I will request that honorable members, we have heard the presentation of the handbook from the PSC, and I have listened to issues raised by honorable members, and I will then humbly propose that this handbook, take it to our legal team of Parliament so that we are guided legally so that we don't have different views on this matter, especially that the matter that have to do with that with Section 2195, because we must understand if it's really legal that the commissioners if it's legal that they determine its Atlantica remuneration, obvious the issues of accommodation outside that Section 2195, especially that speaks to the determination of the president. I think if you agree, honourable members, let's take this to the legal services of Parliament. They will advise us and come back feedback to this portfolio committee. Agree, Chair.
Support that, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you so much, honourable members. If there's no other item except the minutes, Mercy, I will then thank the department led today by the DG and her team, and also the PSC led by the chair and all commissioners and colleagues.
Chair, with due respect, Chairperson, you were wrapping up, but I think I must say something that is the response to my question. Chairperson, I think when the department respond to us, they must also bear in mind that we are not crutch children. So when they respond, I don't think it's correct to say to respond as if the member said you must go and discipline the DGs and ministers from other departments. No, nobody said that. But we were checking to say, is there any regulation that can be put up or any mechanism just to fast track the process? But the way it's been put, I thought maybe you were going to intervene on that one, Chairperson, but I'm sorry you didn't maybe get it the way I got it. Nobody is saying go and discipline other departments, other DGs and ministers. But the regulation from DPSA side to say if the department is not doing well on this one, what is it? That can be. There are many things. The minister can be not because the minister is disciplined. The matter can be brought upon the foresight as they've been saying whatever. But not to say committee members are that ignorant. And not be able to draw the line. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ntuli. I think it was an oversight to myself, and I think you have raised your concern or in terms of the responses from the department, and I think it has been then clarified by yourselves, what was your real question. But I'm so sorry, Honourable Member, and I've noted your concern. If then there's no other issues, Honourable Members, thank you very much to the department and also to the PSC and all colleagues. You are released. Now will remain as honourable members just to conclude the last item, the minutes, Mercy. And we must catch the bus now. It's 28 minutes past 12.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, honourable members. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Chair.
Chair, can I proceed?
Yes, Masi, with the minutes of the 25th October.
Yes, Chair, thank you so much. Good afternoon to you and honorable members, Chair, and of course our colleagues. I have four sets of minutes, Chairperson. They're very short. They were just dealing with the bill. I'm on the minutes of the 25th of October, Chair. We received a response from the department on both the bills. I'm on page one. Of page two, Chair.
Merci. So, Chair, on page one, in terms of people attended, can you correct my initials as RN, not RT?
Noted, Honorable Komane. I'm on page two. I just need to correct that one. It was a professor from the TPSA who was a legal advisor there. I'll correct that one, Chair. I'm on page two. Page three, Chair. There was no, there was nothing much in terms of the deliberations, as the deliberation affected in the report, Chair. So those are the minutes of the 25th, Chair. Thank you so much.
Honourable members, the minutes of the 25th October, any mover for these minutes or any issues? Honourable Kibi?
Thanks, Chair. I move for the adoption of the minutes of the 25th as presented, Honourable Chair. Thank you.
And Mr. Gwanda, Honourable Members, Honourable Nahal.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, for seconds this minutes. Thank you.
The minutes of the 25th October have been adopted and seconded. Next set.
Thank you, Chair. These are the minutes of the 31st October. I'm already on page one, Chair. NSG and the legal services gave a briefing into the committee, Chair. I will move to page two, Chair.
Masi, in all the minutes, please correct my initials.
Yes, I've noted that, Honorable Komane. Apologies for that.
Are you done, Masi?
No, Chair. I'll move quickly, Chair. I was just sorting out the initial Honorable Komane. I'm on page three, Chair. That's the last page, Chair. These are the minutes of the 31st October, Chair.
Honorable members, I'm taking hands, Honorable Nduli, for the minutes of the 31st October.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to adopt this the minutes of the 31st of October.
The minutes of the 31st October adopted. Any second, Honorable Kibi?
Second, the adoption by Honorable Nduli.
Okay, Chair, second, last one, Chair. These are the minutes of the 1st of November. I'm on page. I'll have to amend that initial for Honorable Komane there. Apologies once again. I'm on page two, Chair. Page three, Chair. That's the last page, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
The minutes. Yes, Masi.
Those are the minutes of the 1st of November, Chair.
The minutes of the 1st of November, Honorable Members, Honorable Kibi, follow Honorable Nduli.
Thank you for the adoption of this minute, Honorable Chair. Thank you.
Chair, I thank Honorable Kibi.
Thank you so much, Honorable Kibi and Honorable Nduli.
and me, Venus, Marcy. I think they should be the last one.
Chair. Well, on the 8th of November, Chair. I'm on page 1, Chair. I will also amend the initial of Honorable Komane there. I'm on page 2. I'm on page 3, Chair. Those are the minutes of the 8th of November, Chair. Thank you so much.
Honorable members, those are the minutes of the 8th November. Do you have issues or any hand? Honorable Manedi, followed by Honorable Ntuli.
Chairperson, I move for adoption of the set of minutes presented.
Chairperson, I second Honorable Manedi.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. The minutes of the 8th of November have been adopted and seconded. Anything else, Marcy?
Nothing, Chair. It's adjournment. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Marcy. And thank you very much, Honorable Members, colleagues, and especially...
Chairperson, 1 second. Chair. One second, Chairperson. Honorable Man is with us for the first time after the bereavement at home. Honorable Komane, we're with you as this portfolio committee. Our prayers were with you. And again, much as we send the messages on the group chat, again, we are sincerely sorry for what happened to you and your family. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ntuli, to represent the Portfolio Committee. Stay strong, Honorable Komane, and thank you very much to all of you, Honorable Members and colleagues and our support staff. The time now is 12:36, and the meeting is adjourned. And thank you very much to all of you.
Thank you, Chair. Manza.
Thank you, Chair. Bye. Recording stopped.